Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Soundcheck.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Lots of people seem to love trivia, especially music fans. Like, if I asked you which non-Jewish Calypso star had a big hit with Hava Nagila, you'd probably be interested to know the answer. And you will when we hear the surprising and fascinating history behind that song. And later, I'll ambush the group Band of Horses with a set of trivia questions. If you can't wait, you can read them right now on our website at soundcheck.org, but no fair Googling the answers. Then there's this fun fact. Here in New York, in the East Village, there are two buildings on St. Mark's Place, 96 and 98 St. Mark's, that have been featured in two picturesque moments in rock history. Name them. The moments, not the buildings. I'm waiting. Stumped? Well, trivia experts, the buildings were featured first on the cover of Led Zeppelin's Physical Graffiti in 1975, famous album cover. Then, in 1981, while our listener Eddie was living in an apartment on the first floor, a music video director knocked on his door and, well, I'll let Eddie tell the story.
I was approached the night before the video was being filmed by the director, I thought, who asked me, he rang my doorbell and asked me if they would be able to use our apartment because a major rock band was filming a video. They didn't tell me at that time that it was the Rolling Stones. They just said that, you know, they'd be interested in using our apartment. I still had the contract from the Signorelli Corporation. Got it right here in my hand. And I was paid $40 for this, and it was split between me and my roommate. So that's how much I got for my work for that day.
$40 split three ways, but Eddie ended up in the hit music video for the Rolling Stones song Waiting on a Friend. Again, famous video. It's the one where Mick Jagger is hanging out with some guys on a stoop on St. Mark's Place. He's got three other guys with him, one of whom is Jamaican reggae great Peter Tosh, and he's waiting on a friend. And that friend, of course, is Keith Richards. And Keith arrives, there's high fives all around, and then Mick and Keith walk down the street past Eddie's building to meet some other friends in a bar. And that's it, folks. That is the plot of this video. Here's Eddie again.
At the moment when Mick Jagger and Keith Richards meet on the step before my building, I was looking out the window, and at that point, the same man who had seen me the night before said, "All right, now you get in the window and sit there like you were last night." And at that point, they just started filming me, and that was the first time I knew that I was going to be any part of this video.
You can watch this video on our site, soundcheck.org. We've captured a still picture of Eddie's moment of stardom. He's the blonde guy sitting in a window, looking kind of morose. He's only on screen for a couple of seconds, but those 2 or 3 seconds kind of made him a star.
After it came out, people that I worked with at Trash and Vaudeville, they were going out to clubs where it was being premiered, told me, "Oh my God, you are so in this video. You are really in this video." Right? And so as soon as I saw it, I was shocked. And looking back on it, I am glad that it happened. And strangers still come up to me all the time and say, "Oh my God, are you in this Rolling Stones video?" So anyway, that's my little story in a nutshell. And I hope you have a good day. Bye.
thanks to Eddie for his story. You can tell us about the time you were in a music video. Leave a message at 646-493-7939. Coming up, a museum curator tries to change my mind about Hava Nagila. She says it's more than the cliched wedding song I think it is. Will I go over to the dark side? Will you? Find out next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Over the summer, the U.S. Olympic gymnast Allie Raisman performed her floor routine to a universally familiar song, Hava Nagila. Notice I said universally familiar, not universally popular. I mean, sure, it's played at weddings and bar mitzvahs and now the Olympics, too, but it's not really everyone's favorite. But the Museum of Jewish Heritage is opening an entire exhibit devoted to the history. The surprising history of Hava Nagila. Melissa Martins is the curator of the exhibit. Melissa, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John.
So why are we talking about Hava Nagila?
Well, just like you said, I think almost everyone in the world knows the song Hava Nagila, or they think they know the song Hava Nagila, but very few people know the interesting backstory to the song.
Now, was the Allie Raisman thing in the Olympics just a happy coincidence, or did that get the wheels turning for this?
It was. I'm sure Allie had been working on that routine for some time, just as we were working on our exhibition for some time, but the two just happened to collide, and it does make our concluding point perfectly that even though we think about this song as a song of parties of days gone by, maybe a song people have heard too many times, it's still alive and well in popular culture, whether it's Allie Raisman or on YouTube. Every single day, someone in the world posts a new rendition of Hava Nagila. So we wanted to find out why, and what is the story?
Well, the exhibit is actually called Hava Nagila, A Song for the People. People do have strong feelings about Hava Nagila, it seems.
They do, and it's always been a song that's been democratic, and I think that's one of the reasons that it's so familiar to our ears, is that it's not a song that's high culture, it's not a song that's difficult to sing. Even if you don't know the lyrics, you could sing along. Even if you don't know the dance steps, you could join in a circle together and move
you're
around.
You're about to break into song, aren't you?
I might at some point. So,
go ahead, go for it.
I know Hava Nagila. But a lot of people, after those two words, they kind of peter out. They just keep saying Hava Nagila. Right. But there are very interesting lyrics and this interesting history that the song actually started off as a wordless melody in what is today Ukraine, in a village called Sadagora, where the Hasidim who lived there followed a particular rabbi, and this was part of their repertoire of nigunim, or wordless Hasidic tunes, in which they'd use these spiritual melodies to help engage with the divine.
So it was a niggun, the singular of nigunim.
Correct.
Listeners, niggun or not, Hava Nagila is a song of the people. It's up on YouTube, as Melissa's telling us every day. Do you love it or hate it? And why? Tell us your story on the Soundcheck website, soundcheck.org. Melissa, let me read you a couple of things that came in on Twitter.
Great.
Anel Victoria on Twitter writes, cornball and hackneyed, but Allie Raisman's updated version worked very well for Olympic gymnastics. And someone with the handle Songlines Record on Twitter wrote this, Hava Nagila? Hate it. Too many bad childhood memories of forced horror dancing.
Sounds like a bad party.
Well, but I mean, I think it is perceived by some people as being kind of a cliche of Jewish music at this point. So How did that happen?
Yeah, how did we get there? That's a great question. Well, this song that I said came from this village in Ukraine, made its way with Jewish settlers to Palestine around the turn of the century, where a famous Jewish musicologist wrote lyrics for the song. Most likely, it's also possible a student he was working with also worked on the lyrics, and the lyrics came from a book of Psalms. And it basically was from the phrase, this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad on it. Mm-hmm. And so the momentum of this song became a source of nationalistic pride for a Jewish homeland. It followed other people in Zionist circles and Jewish educational circles in the 20s and 30s. It merged with the Hora dance. And then in the post-war era, as American Jewish life became more cemented and more solidified, this song, an expression of pride, then became a party song because it has such a great dance beat. It's mm-hmm. so easy to sing that it became the anthem of every Jewish celebration. So that's why people today feel they've heard it a million times.
Because they probably have.
They possibly have.
So A.Z. Edelson is the name of this musicologist?
Correct. Edelson, yeah.
Edelson. So he puts lyrics to this wordless tune from the Hasidic community of Ukraine, and in 1922 makes a recording of Hava Nagila. This was a party tune?
That's right. And I think it's so surprising.
It's a little lugubrious sounding for a party, isn't it?
That's why it's so surprising that we think of it as this song, as this cliche of tapping our toes and frantically moving around in a circle, because it sounds, this version is the earliest recording we know of the song Hava Nagila. It's put together by Edelson with a mm-hmm. choir who performs it in 1922, and it's released with an album of Jewish folk songs in Hebrew. And as you could tell, this is the closest thing we have to the root of what maybe it sounded like in the Ukraine as a spiritual melody.
Right, yeah.
And by 1929 is when other source books show us that it was so closely associated with the Hora dance, which came from Romania to Palestine.
That's the circle dance.
Exactly, yeah. And became part of agricultural life and a democratic celebrating. Again, it's a dance that has no beginning, it has no end. Anyone could join at any time. And this song was the one that was most closely cited with it by 1929.
We're speaking with Melissa Martins. She's the curator at the Museum of Jewish Heritage of their exhibit called Hava Nagila, A Song for the People, which is running through summer of 2013. And again, it's a tune that pretty much everybody knows and lots of people have strong feelings about. What do the words Hava Nagila actually mean?
It means, come, let us rejoice.
Okay. And how did it go from something that, you know, starts in Ukraine, becomes a part of Jewish culture? You mentioned this kind of Zionist use of it as a kind of folk song of Jewish pride and stuff. How does it transcend that to become a part of the global jukebox?
I think it's interesting that it becomes so closely associated as a part of Jewish folk culture and the revival of the Hebrew language, which happened in the 20th century with the founding of the State of Israel, that song then, because of its catchy tune and its sincere ethnic connections, gets picked up by other singers who are performing and recording a repertoire of global music. Mm-hmm. And one of the most famous performances of this is Harry Belafonte. And it's funny because we think of the song Hava Nagila, and the person who's probably most responsible for making it famous is Harry Belafonte. He said that song and the Banana Boat song, Deo, mm-hmm. were his two most requested numbers. He starts singing it in the Village Vanguard in the 50s. He also travels to Germany, where he sees that German kids have learned to sing it, and he becomes very touched and moved because he realized there's a reconciliation and a healing going on internationally, partly through this song. He's in America. He records it in 1957 on the album An Evening with Belafonte, and then 1959 performs it to thousands at Carnegie Hall, and it explodes on the global jukebox.
Havana Gila v'nismacha Havana Gila Havana Gila v'nismacha Havana Ranana Havana Ranana v'nismacha Havana Ranana Havana Ranana Havana Ranana v'nismacha Uru Achim belev sameach
Harry Belafonte, Hava Nagila, live at Carnegie Hall in 1959. And Melissa, you said it was kind of a surprising song for him. I mean, he was, of course, Deo, the Banana Boat song, that was his culture. This was not. And yet that's a really convincing performance.
Right. You could tell how seriously he's taking it. He is not doing a spoof of Hava Nagila with this version in 1959.
So in 1959, were people getting married to Hava Nagila? Was it already part of, you know, wedding ceremonies and stuff?
By the 50s and 60s, it really does then join the repertoire of Jewish celebration music.
And then into non-Jewish celebrations as well? Or does that happen later?
It takes on at least two tracks, starting with this kind of peak popularity moment around 1959 that Belafonte records it. It was already in the musical repertoire. Recording artists such as the Barry Sisters had been working with it in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. They started off as the Begelman Sisters, changed their name, got on the radio show Yiddish Melodies and Swing, and there was the Klezmer movement and Yiddish radio, and they're taking Yiddish melodies and setting them to a swing beat.
Mm-hmm.
And they come up with this really lively, danceable version.
Whirl and turn about, lift up your arms and shout, join hands, skip along, dance, everyone dance. Turn left, turn right, hold tight, lift your feet, the heart will follow, lift your voice, fill the hollow, spread your wings like the swallow, spread your wings like the swallow, fly away, greet the day, dance, dance, everybody dance.
So that version is already popular. It's already enjoyed by the Jewish community. Harry Belafonte has his breakthrough recording, and after that, almost everyone takes a crack at Hava Nagila.
Hmm.
There was a Swedish band called the Spotniks. There was Dick Dale's surf version, Flora Purim, Josephine Baker, Francis.
Wow, that's a really eclectic list of people.
There are really dozens and dozens of recordings. You could go to old record album stores and find versions of Hava Nagila by so many different performers around the world in all different languages.
Or you can go to our website where we have a Spotify playlist of all of these different recordings and interpretations of Hava Nagila. The subject of the exhibit, Hava Nagila, A Song for the People at the Museum of Jewish Heritage. Melissa Martins is the curator. And somehow, Hava Nagila, by the 60s, is not done. It's not entered the realm of cliche completely. It becomes associated with, you know, societal change, with civil rights.
Yeah, it's really interesting that by the 60s, the song is familiar enough that the tune becomes a platform for other messaging. And I think that even connects us to where we are today, that we could think of it in this postmodern framework, that you have to be familiar with a song in order to have varied reactions and interpretations of it, because now almost everybody knows the song Hava Nagila.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some other really interesting recordings that happen in the 60s. And one is by Lena Horne. And the lyrics get rewritten by Comden Green and Jules Stein for a civil rights benefit. She performs it 1963. It gets recorded on her album Now. And it's a really politically charged civil rights anthem, where they write these new lyrics to the tune of Hava Nagila, and she proclaims, now is the moment, now is the time, we've stood by long enough. And it's this really interesting messaging. At the same time, we're also seeing artists such as Alan Sherman, who's a parodist and Jewish American.
Hello, mother, hello, father.
Exactly. He's able to use the tune to make fun of the Jewish suburban experience in America.
Well, all right. So from the sublime to the ridiculous, let's hear both. Lena Horne, 1963, part of that whole series of protests, Washington Square Park here in New York. And then Alan Sherman with not Hava Nagila, but Harvey and Sheila.
What's right constitutionally? I went and took a look in my old history book. It's there in black and white for all to see.
And Sheila Harvey, and Sheila Harvey, and Sheila, oh, the day they met. Harvey and Sheila Harvey, and Sheila Harvey, and Sheila, no one will forget. Harvey's a CPA, he works for IBM. He went to MIT and got his PhD. Sheila's a girl I know at BBDNO. She works the PBX and makes out the checks. Then came one great day when Harvey took the elevator. Sheila got in two floors later. Soon they both felt they were falling. Everyone heard Sheila calling, ring the bell, but they fell. Harv and Sheila fell in love.
That is Alan Sherman with Harvey and Sheila. And before that, Lena Horne with a song called Now. Both of those are clearly Hava Nagila with different words. From the early 60s, Lena Horne recorded in 63, Alan Sherman in 62. And, I mean, how many different ways, how many different tropes are there to play with the words Hava Nagila?
I feel like it could go on forever, which is one of the reasons that the song has stuck with us, whether you like it or not, because people keep finding new messaging or new ways to celebrate the song or to transmit new versions of new messages over time.
Right. Now, you have found a way to celebrate the song for the opening of the exhibit, Hava Nagila, Song for the People, at the Museum of Jewish Heritage. What is this celebration?
That's right. We got inspired. We saw an old clip from Laugh-In where someone was singing Hava Nagila, and she was using the Hava as have a. And so we thought that the perfect signature cocktail for our project would be the Hava Tequila. So, John, I brought for you a little Hava Tequila, and it's a blood orange margarita. Essentially.
Really?
It echoes the color scheme of the exhibition, which is extremely vibrant. It has white tequila, blood orange juice, and a little bit of Cointreau. And I think you'll quite like it. You'll have to let me know if it makes you want to sing and dance.
All right. Well, it looks great. Let's see. You know, I have to say, I'm suddenly feeling a little warmer and fuzzier towards Hava Nagila.
Yeah, I can see that. It's working.
So, I mean, it has been, as you say, on Laugh-In. It's been in The Simpsons. I'm actually going to have a little more of this. This is good. And, you know, it's been all over our culture. It's you actually asked people for this exhibition to, you know, kind of send in photos or stories, documents, things like that. What did you get?
Well, we absolutely wanted to survey the contemporary landscape, knowing that people feel so differently about this song, but almost everyone has had an encounter with it. So the one venue I mentioned is that YouTube has thousands of videos where everyday people or performers are putting up punk rock versions, wedding celebrations, postmodern interpretations, dances, there's flash mobs, there's protesters, Occupy has used it. And so we wanted to survey that material, but we wanted to also ask everyday people to send us their photos of people singing, dancing, doing whatever to the song. And so we've started to receive a great number of photographs that are fantastic. And in the exhibit, we have a pinup board where we can rotate photographs. Mm-hmm. So if we get great ones and permission to do so, then we are happy to rotate in everyday people photos into the exhibition as it continues to go on through summer.
Through summer of 2013, the exhibition is called Hava Nagila, A Song for the People at the Museum of Jewish Heritage. Melissa Martins is the curator. And Hava Tequila, L'chaim.
Cheers.
Melissa Martins, my guest on Soundcheck. Thanks very much.
Thanks, John.
In the background, surf guitarist Dick Dale and his version of Hava Nagila. So now what do you think about the song? Love it? Hate it? We want to hear your opinion. Leave us a comment on soundcheck.org or call us at 646-493-7939. That's 646-493-7939. And joining me here in the studio with a few of your comments is Soundcheck producer Greta Cohn. Greta, I noticed you didn't bring me anything to drink. What did you bring?
Well, I brought you some great voicemails from some of our Soundcheck listeners. We got a really great response from our call out. And the first voicemail I want to play for you is from a listener on Long Island. Here's what she had to say.
Hi there. I'm calling from the Gold Coast of Long Island, and I would call myself a very good Shiksa girl. When it comes to Hava Nagila Hava, I love it. It reminds me of times when I had a chance to learn from friends about Jewish culture, and it was a song where I was welcomed into the dance, and I think it's a wonderfully human tune.
Well, what did she call herself? A very nice Shiksa girl.
She calls herself a nice Shiksa girl, which is just a nice non-Jewish girl.
Okay.
So we got another voicemail from a listener named Jenny in Brooklyn, and here's what she had to say.
When I was growing up in Los Angeles in the 70s, my brothers used to sing this song, and it went, Hava Nagila, have two Nagilas, have three Nagilas, they're very small. And it wasn't till a couple years later that I realized that wasn't the actual song, because we were Jewish, but not that Jewish. And I've never heard anybody else sing that version, but I'm thinking my brothers did not make it up. That's all. I'm Jenny from Brooklyn. Thanks.
And as we know, her brothers did not make up that song.
I guess not, now that we know the true story. Where is it from?
It's from Laughing. Yeah, inspired the Hava Tequila.
Can I just say this Hava Tequila is not small.
No, it's not.
Very persuasive, though.
Still drinking that thing.
So those are some of the voicemails, Greta, that came in. What else have we gotten?
Well, we asked listeners on Twitter to tell us about whether they love or loathe Hava Nagila. And Cher Shayla Curl tweeted this at us. Love it. Not Jewish, but my third grade teacher was and taught us. Still remember all the words. Does that count? I think so.
Okay.
HM tweeted this. The guy who recorded that version, I heard at every bar mitzvah in the early 2000s, must be loaded. I wonder which version that is.
I wonder which version of loaded he means.
Oh. Well, you're the one with the Hava Tequila, so.
All right.
And over on Facebook, Doug points us to the super funky 1970s version by this duo called Dia Prometido. They're a duo consisting of an Iranian musician and a Chilean musician.
Olay.
I love that.
So Doug said super funky 1970s. He didn't tell us it was like flamenco funk.
Oh. So what do you think, John? Is this going to sway you over to the other side?
You know, between this, what is it, Dia Prometido and my little Hava Tequila, I'm seeing the benefits of this thrice familiar Jewish tune. Soundcheck producer Greta Cohn here with some of your calls and comments. Thanks, Greta.
Sure thing, John.
And tell us what you think of Hava Nagila. You can leave us a message at 646-493-7939 or post a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. Still to come, there's a lot to love about Band of Horses and how they've combined Southern rock with indie pop. They'll join us to play songs from their new album and, though they don't know it yet, to participate in a round of trivia. That's coming up next on Soundcheck.
Soundcheck.
Oh, how will we get this home? This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Band of Horses, who earned a Grammy nomination for their last album, Infinite Arms, will appeal to fans of classic rock and of facial hair. They are, by unanimous acclaim, the second best bearded band in rock, after ZZ Top, of course. Okay, I might be making some of this up, but the beards are real, and so is Band of Horses' new album, Mirage Rock. It was actually produced by Glyn Johns, the Hall of Fame producer who helped define the sound of classic rock with the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, and many others. Band of Horses are here in our studio to play some of Mirage Rock live and unplugged for us on Soundcheck. And we'll start with a song called Slow, Cruel Hands of Time.
Biding of time, getting stuck in my mind as a boat to roll. 2 hours later, back in my neighborhood where everything just stopped. It still looks the same, they remember my name, stepping in for a cup full. As a big city man, I used to rumble with back in high school. The slow, cruel hand of time turn you into molten lava. Oh my. Oh, pace on the ride, you can stop for a while, look out for the policeman. No street lamps, only three buildings, and one of them's vacant. It's ticking all day, the pack's feeling heavy, and soon the night. Backwards down the mountain, the axle is grinding, pulling to the wrong drive. The sky. Slow climb
That is Band of Horses, live and unplugged in the Soundcheck studio. The song's called Slow, Cruel Hands of Time, and it appears on the brand new album by Band of Horses called Mirage Rock. Ben Bridwell singing, playing acoustic guitar. Ryan Monroe doing some singing, another acoustic guitar. Tyler Ramsey, yes, yet another acoustic guitar. And Bill Reynolds with the acoustic bass. Guys, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great to be back.
Ben, I understand that when you're home, this is a touring band, so being home doesn't happen a lot, but when you are home, you like to have these family trivia night things on a weekly basis. And I feel bad that you're not home and can't do that, but you have your kind of road family here.
Absolutely, yeah. We should start doing some sort of trivia while we're on tour just to get the real home experience.
I am going to help you with that right now.
Oh, my goodness.
I have come up with some trivia questions for us today.
Ready.
In the categories of music, sports, and just general world stuff.
Wonderful.
First two would be okay. General world stuff would be kind of...
I don't recall giving you a choice in the matter.
Yes. Yes.
You're getting all three. But I'll give you the music one first.
Okay.
And you can...
Of course,
you know, decide. You're a family. In 1964, on which show did the Beatles make their first U.S. television appearance?
Ed Sullivan Show.
Wrong.
Dang it.
Oh, wait.
I already answered it for us without consulting.
Oh, yeah. See, you didn't consult, and you sprang into action, and your answer was wrong.
Man. Okay.
Can you think what it would have been?
Am I going to allow a second answer
No.
here?
No,
I don't think I am.
Not.
I don't think I am.
What do you think, Bill?
Morning show or something?
Go ahead.
The correct answer is The Tonight Show with Jack Parr.
Oh, I would have never heard of Jack Parr.
Before they did The Ed Sullivan Show, they did Jack Parr's Tonight Show.
What was the big deal? Why didn't the Jack Parr one?
The Ed Sullivan one was the one with all the screaming kids.
Right,
so
that's when it really hit.
Yep.
Sorry, you're the one with the questions.
Thank you. I'm going to need that again someday, I'm sure. Thank you.
All right, we'll come back to trivia later, but let me ask you about the new record, Mirage Rock. Ben, this is produced by Glyn Johns, who the Beatles is one of the few classic rock bands he didn't work with. The Stones, The Who, Zeppelin, and now you guys.
Actually, that trivia question, I believe you might miss, because he did work with the Beatles.
Oh, did he?
On Let It Be, did the original sessions.
And then, of course, yeah.
Then it got taken over.
By Phil Spector.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're learning something today. This is awesome. Now, I completely forgot what the question was.
So what did that do for, like, the way you guys made this record as opposed to the way you made the last album?
Well, it was cool. He was like another member. He had all the input, just as we did, with the material that we wanted to throw down. Mm-hmm. And we took his suggestions on the structure of the songs and things like that, just like we would anybody else in the band. He was a member for about 6 weeks there. Yeah.
I guess, you know, a lot of people who aren't in the business wonder what the producer does. I mean, is he sort of saying, I want you to lay another level of guitar on top of what you've already done? Is he saying, I want you all in the same place at the same time? Or is he saying, I don't want anybody on top of anybody else? I mean, how does that work?
Hmm. Yeah, I guess he does definitely, like, check to make sure you're not doing too much or too little. What do you guys think?
Producers' roles can just run the whole gamut.
Yeah.
It can be getting coffee, hanging out, or it can be...
I somehow have difficulty imagining Glyn Johns running out and getting you guys coffee.
Right. But most of the time, getting a producer is the person who has the final say.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically, it's like, if they like it, it's generally like it's their call.
Yeah.
The objective ears, you know, away from, obviously, the pressure of being in the band.
So the resulting album is called Mirage Rock. It's out now. The band is Band of Horses. They're playing on Saturday, September 29th at Central Park. That's that Global Poverty Project,
exactly.
Right? And they're playing for us, unplugged, here in the studio. Now, Ryan, the next song that you guys are going to play, this is yours, right?
Yep.
From the previous album, Infinite Arms?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's my contribution to that record.
And the first time, Ben, that you were not the lead singer on a Band of Horses thing, right?
I can't remember the sequence of that album, but Tyler had a song on the last one as well with Evening Kitchen, a lead vocal. But yeah, I think Ryan gets first. I think he had earlier in the track list.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
playing the role of Keith to Ben's Mick. Here is Ryan and the rest of the guys. Band of Horses playing live on Soundcheck. This song is called Older. That is Band of Horses. Look like you're trying to decide whether you're done over there or not. Older is the name of the song. It appears on their last album, Infinite Arms. The new one is out now called Mirage Rock. Once again, Ben Bridwell, Ryan Monroe, Tyler Ramsey all singing and playing guitars, Bill Reynolds playing an acoustic bass. Creighton Barrett's here.
He's our producer in there.
He's just, he's here for moral support, the drummer of Band of Horses. You guys, Ben, you covered a CeeLo Green song.
Yes, we did.
And the one you chose was Georgia. Yeah. Why that particular song?
Well, first he had covered one of ours, and I was just blown away by the cover. I could not believe it, man. So well timed, also with him just taking off. And my family's from Atlanta, and a lot of the imagery in that song goes all around that whole area. And because of my affinity for the University of Georgia Bulldog football team in particular, it seemed like a good chance to get some inspiration into it, you know?
So sports are important to you. I mean, you wrote a piece called Detlef Schrempf about the German-born NBA star
of, course,
of the 90s. So my next trivia question for you comes from the
Chicago
world.
Bulls. Okay, wait. Gotta consult.
Comes from the world of sports. In the museum section of the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum, which, as you know, is in Cooperstown, New York, two men who never set foot on a professional baseball field are featured prominently. Who are they? They were not ball players, owners, umpires.
Not even sportscasters.
Not sportscasters. Two of them.
What?
These two men never set foot on a professional baseball field, but they are both featured prominently in the National Baseball Hall of Fame's museum.
We'll take caller number seven.
Yeah. Is that a key part of the question? Professional baseball?
Not really.
Okay.
Simply to say that these were not in any way, shape, or form baseball people.
Oh, was it League of Their Own? This two?
No. Although good answer.
Who's that guy with the Phillies used to walk on his hands?
The fanatic?
Yeah.
No. It's nope. These two men are linked. It's a single answer, sort of, because it's two guys who are forever linked together.
It's
all right. Abbott and Costello.
Oh God! Wow. Who's on first?
Who's on first?
Oh. No way.
The famous recording of their comedy routine. Who's on first?
You've got great questions, man. I'm gonna be so prepared when I get home.
All right. The third one, which we'll get to later, I'll give you a multiple choice, so you'll have like a 1 in 4 chance of getting that one right. Ben Bridwell, alleged trivia.
I know, right?
Band of Horses are with us on Soundcheck today. So what do you guys want to play for us? You want to go back to the new record?
Yeah, we'll go back to the new record for, I believe the second track on it is called How to Live. And we'll play that one acoustically.
Band of Horses, live on Soundcheck.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm giving advice to others. Take more than I can give. It's a bird's eye view of what I want you to do or how to live. I really don't have to suffer. Still do it anyway. I'm a diamond in the rough, or I'm a dirt claw. Guess what? I lost my job. Well, it's just my love. Reveal you've always been the actor. Those puppy dog eyes. Y'all's telling the truth, the other one is lying. It's someone else's fault so often. Getting rude or getting tall. It's a great big world, all in your translations just go on. And so what? Made a mistake that you tried to hide in the tiniest lie. Gets a little bit larger every day and it grows till it's out of control. Still did it anyway.
what? You're getting old. Still gotta grow up.
Well, there's all kinds of shenanigans going on. I'm surprised you actually got a song out of that. Band of Horses. Horsing around here in the Soundcheck studio. There are pics flying all over the place. And that is called How to Live. And you'll find a full-on version of that on the new Band of Horses album called Mirage Rock. Ben Bridwell, Ryan Monroe, Tyler Ramsey, Bill Reynolds here in the studio, Creighton Barrett, you know, out over in the control room as opposed to being behind the drum kit.
Live blogging.
Because they are all playing unplugged. And if Creighton started wailing away on the drums, we'd need all kind of plugs all of a sudden. So the album, you know, there are songs like Feud, which we heard a little bit of at the beginning, Knock Knock, which is the single, which we'll hear a bit of in a moment, Dumpster World. I mean, these are full-on, like, rockin' electric tracks. And then there have also been, you know, songs that are much more acoustic. And it kind of reminds me of the way Neil Young, over the course of his career, so easily moved from the one to the other. Was he kind of a touchstone for you guys?
Always. Even in the very first days of the band, I don't think I would have even opened my mouth to sing if I didn't learn from listening to Neil growing up my whole life. So, yeah, he's a huge influence on my songwriting and the register to sing at, for sure.
Now, let me ask you guys, and this is mostly Ben for you and Tyler, and Ryan to a lesser extent, the beards.
Right.
You're on the road. Isn't that just like one more thing that you have to take care of?
It's one less thing you have to take care of.
Nothing, one less thing to charge up and, you know, like some shaver or something like that. You don't have to worry about it at all. It's like it's a lower half face mask, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome, man.
Totally awesome.
It is part of the Band of Horses look over the years. All right, so when you're home, there's still no shaving happening, huh?
No.
Okay.
Even less.
But when Ben is home, he likes to do this family trivia thing weekly. And so here is your third and final trivia question. This is in the general category of world stuff. Now, you all know the Great Pyramid of Egypt, right? Great Pyramid of Egypt, built of stone. There is enough stone in the Great Pyramid of Egypt to build a 6-foot-high wall around A, Central Park, B, all of New York City, C, all of New York State, D, France.
My word.
One pyramid, 6-foot-high wall around one of those choices. Central Park, New York City, New York State, France.
I would go with New York City.
Sure.
It seems like it could be New York State. Could be the entire world. I have no idea. It's big.
Never seen it in person. So.
What do you think?
I say NYC.
Good answer. Good answer.
Yeah, good answer.
Good answer.
Ryan.
Good answer.
The answer is New York City. Is that your answer?
It is our answer.
Final answer?
That's our final answer.
The correct answer is France.
Bill said France. Bill said France. Okay. Didn't say it loud enough.
I did not hear Bill say France.
He did. We got video running. All
right, next time we come in, we're going to have lots of coffee before we get in there. We'll be ready for you.
All right. And maybe, you know, bring a few trivia questions of your own. We'll have a little back and a little ping pong. A little trivia ping pong. Speaking of trivia, this is an even more trivial sort of follow-up to my Abbott and Costello question, which normally gets asked, who are the only two guys in the Hall of Fame who haven't, you know, been on a baseball field? They're not actually in the Hall of Fame. That's why I said they're in the museum part of the Hall of Fame.
We might avoid a
very familiar trivia question problem.
Instead of coffee, we're just going to hit the books.
All right. In the meantime, guys, Mirage Rock, it rocks. Thank you guys for joining us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to see you again.
This is Soundcheck. And that's going to do it for Soundcheck. Tomorrow, the story of a once obscure album called Dreamin' Wild, recorded by the teenage brothers Donnie and Joe Emerson on their family farm in Washington State in 1979. It's earning a new cult of fans thanks to a reissue. plus Mercury Prize nominee Leanne LaHavas performs in our studio. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC and New York Public Radio. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our engineering team includes Paul Schneider and George Wellington. The show is produced by Greta Cohn and Katie Bishop. Our digital producer is Mike Katziff. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. Our interns are Ashanta Jackson and Harrison Knowles. And our jingles today came from our listeners Greta Gertler and Sky Filippi. I'm John Schaefer. Tune in tomorrow at 9 for another Soundcheck.